I'm Zach. This is Faith Connection Bible Study. We are a church in Wilton Center, Illinois, and this is our members' session, a time where I teach what we are learning together during our Bible study time. We believe in the local church, and what that means to us is this time does not replace our time together or should be used for broad consumption or profit. If you are in our area, I highly recommend you attend because there's so much more to be gained meeting and fellowshipping in person, the questions that lead us down the good rabbit holes, all of that stuff. So if you're in the area, look us up. We're, again, in Wilton Center, but you can find us at faithconnectionwc.com for all of our meeting times. And with that, let's get into it. We continue our series on trees. Our series on trees. It's interesting because we say trees, but we don't really mean trees. And for those of you who've been following along, you know exactly what I mean. Our goals, we've always had three goals. Two of them are for just about every Bible study, and then one specifically for this one. We want to dive deeper in our connection to our faith. Again, the Bible is the inspired word of God. The Spirit works through these words, and the Spirit's job is to lead us back to Jesus. And I believe that in that, we get a deeper relationship in our faith with Jesus, with God. So that's goal number one. Goal number two is we get new tools. Hopefully, what we're learning here gives you a set of tools in your toolbox that whenever you're hearing Scripture, reading Scripture, engaging with any kind of Scripture at any point in time, there are some things for you to draw on that maybe you would catch now that you have these tools versus not. Again, I don't think everybody needs a commentary set next to them when they read their Bibles, but I also think part of going to church is empowering the people to engage with the word and ministry as best they can, and that means equipping people. Finally, our third goal is to see how trees symbolically inform us of who we are, who we're meant to be, and how we connect with God. Strange thing saying from trees, but those of you who have been following along, you get it. All right, so the pattern has been set that we are looking for trees and high places, God present, and there a decision being made. So sometimes they'll mention trees. Now more often they'll say high places, and we're supposed to just start connecting that together. God is present there. Somehow God is going to be in that place, and there will be a decision made. So to recap, we've talked about Adam and Eve and how it sets the pattern. How, as royal priests, they were there. There was a tree that represents God's presence and abundant life. And how they were connected through language with trees. So, yeah, the first tree we get to see as something that represents God's presence and abundant life. And then with Noah, our next time we're talking about trees, the tree is a vehicle for salvation. The tree of good and bad is present, is there. That tree is symbolized both by the ark itself, getting the wood, making it there, and having it be used for the altar. So it's kind of this twofold symbol. It is both the tree of life and the tree of knowing good and bad, right? In the pattern. So the tree of knowing good and bad becomes the tree of life. And again, becomes the tree of knowing good and bad. What are you going to do once you get off the boat? Once you get off and things have been done, well, you make an altar, and he uses the ark, the wood from the ark, to burn the sacrifices to help make the altar. And in doing so, there's another good decision, and it leads again to the life, to the tree of life, to abundance of life. So we see how that tree just kind of plays on multiple levels. Abraham introduces the tree of good and bad as the altar of sacrifice. So it is not just an altar being built, but an altar of sacrifice. One must sacrifice to have access to the tree of life. And we see that most prominently in the story of Abraham and Isaac, where he takes Isaac up. So we had mentioned in our Bible study that, yes, there's the track that we took previously with the story of Abraham, which is the less known. But the more known is that, you know, the tree of knowing good and bad is represented by the tree of that he cut down, put on Isaac's back. And as he was willing to sacrifice all and listen to the voice of God, rather than the voice of the serpent, rather than the voice of wife, whoever else, Lot, he listens to the voice of God, and that has deemed him righteous. And because of his willingness to sacrifice at the altar, he has access to the tree of life. Moses adds a layer to that where there is self-sacrifice, that he is willing to sacrifice himself as the intercessor. We saw him behaving as intercessor from the very beginning at the bitter waters, then again at the mountain, Mount Sinai. And once the golden calf happens, he again intercedes, but this time says, you know, if you're going to blot them out, blot me too. Take me out. I will sacrifice myself on behalf of them. And this ultimately leads to transformation, because we see him get the blessing of God passing by him. He gets to see God, and that gives him the glory, the shiningness of reflecting God so well. So now we're going to jump. We're going to go from realistically Exodus forward. So when we're going into the land, we could see that they begin talking of high places. In Numbers 21, verse 28, Ar of Moab, the king of the high places of Arnon. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, Deuteronomy 32, 13. So again, looking beyond Exodus, we see in Numbers and Deuteronomy, we have more trees, high places being discussed. And actually, towards the end of Deuteronomy, in chapter 33, we hear, "Blessed are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by Yahweh. He is your shield and helper and your glorious sword. So your enemies will cringe before you, and you will tread upon their high places." So we also get this idea of their purpose, what they are going to be doing in the Promised Land. In this new space where people are worshiping other gods on high places, probably by trees, right? Because that's the pattern. They're not making the best decision because they're not worshiping the right God. I say that using air quotes. So, again, before we get into the land, we are told about competing high places and Israel and their God's role and relationship with these high places. So the story, really, if we want to pick it up with a continuance of our theme, we go to Jerusalem as a new Eden. And this starts with David's story. David captures and establishes Jerusalem as the capital, right? That happens in 2 Samuel 5. So if you want, you can open up your Bibles and read along here with me. So 2 Samuel chapter 5, and we're going to start in verse 6 and 7, then jump to 11 and 12. And it says, "The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, 'You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off.' They thought, 'David cannot get in here.' Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, which is the city of David. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent envoys to David, along with cedar logs and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. Then David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel." So, again, imagine Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the reason why they didn't think he was getting in is because it's kind of on this mound. It's this high place naturally. we already know that this is technically the spot where Abraham was supposed to offer Isaac. And so up on this high place, David finds himself at the top. He is now king, and he recognizes God has made him king because he's there. And not just there, but all of a sudden, David is surrounded by trees on this high place. He's in like this very new Eden-like place, right? Because his house is built by trees on a high place. And of course, what does he do? He then brings the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. Now, remember from last week, the Ark of the Covenant has symbolic reference to the Tree of Life. That is where the presence of God is. That is also considered God's throne. But when we're looking at the design of the tabernacle and the temple, as compared to Eden, right? There's Eden, the garden. Then in the middle is the Tree of Life. And in the tabernacle, there is the courts, the holy place, and the Holy of Holies, right? And the Holy of Holies holds the Ark of the Covenant. So symbolically, it takes the place of the Tree of Life. And so he's bringing the Tree of Life up there. So if you go to the very next chapter, you see the Ark being brought in chapter 6. If we read verses 13 through 15 and 17 through 19. Which says, when those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in a place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisin to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. So here you see him putting up on this high place in this mountain where now his house made of trees has come. It has been sacrificed the whole way there. He's doing it right. There's a story where he did it wrong when he first attempted this, right? But now he's doing it right. He's got it all the way up. He's shown the proper respect, and he has planted the ark up on this mountain, if you will, right? He's planted the Tree of Life on the top in the middle of the city at the high place, surrounded by trees. And he's wearing an ephod as he's doing this, and he's worshiping. Ephod is typically something that a priest wears. So even though he has already understood himself to be king, he's kind of taking this priestly role, and he's worshiping, and he's doing kind of what a human is supposed to be doing. And he finds himself up on top, and once he's up on top, on the high place, being this king-priest amalgamation, which is what Adam and Eve were meant to be, he then blesses the people. Yes, on behalf of God, but he blesses the people. That's something really a priest is only supposed to do, right? Aaron is told that he's supposed to bless the people. And so now we have him doing that, and you can imagine it's be fruitful, multiply. Now we have a capital city. Now we're in the holy place. Now we are in the holy land. Be fruitful, multiply. And then he gives out bread and cake with dates and raisins, fruit from the trees. He's literally giving them bread, things to eat, yes, which is made from grains and things of the ground, plants and things, fruits from trees. And so everybody is getting a piece of the fruit and the trees, and they are taking from the trees and the abundance that God has provided now in this new Eden place. I mean, you can't get more in our face about this trying to be a new Eden, right? And of course, from there, we're told he's doing good. David is doing so good that he says, you know what? I think I'm going to build a house for the Lord. If I'm in a house and a palace, then so should God. He shouldn't be in a tent. And God says, no, thank you. I'm fine. Right? I'm good. Thanks. But how about this? I'm going to turn around and do something different for you, which we find in 2 Samuel chapter 7, starting in verse 8. Now then, tell my servant David, because he sends somebody to talk to him, a prophet, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture, from tending the flock, and appointed the ruler over my people Israel. Wow, that sounds a lot like Moses. Right? I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great. Oh, that's a quote from Abraham. Like the names of the greatest men on earth. And I will provide a place for my people and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Oh, so now Israel is going to be like the new garden. They are symbolically being the trees that are being planted, right? Wicked people will not oppress them anymore as they did at the beginning. And have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your seed to succeed you. Your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. So this is the great Davidic promise. This is where we get the Davidic line from. This is where, right, we have already been seeing how David has really kind of been painted in the story as the new snake crusher, and he's doing pretty good. I mean, he's got a new symbolic Eden already there in Jerusalem. Things go good. And God says, you are not it, but there will be one from you. So now we get even more details if we're following along with the snake crusher theme, the Messiah theme, that it's going to be from the line of David that this one comes. But again, God promises to plant a new garden from the seed of David. That from that seed, the planting of the people will grow this forest, this new Eden. And just like God planted people in Eden, now he is going to plant a new people in this new Eden. And he goes back to the promise of Exodus 15:17. Moses declares God will plant his people on a mountain of his choosing. So now when David seeks to make God a house, God turns around and says, he will raise up a seed from David that will build a throne and God's kingdom. David is not the one, but the one is coming. Right? So that's really interesting. We are finding that Eden is connected now. This new Eden is now connected with God's kingdom and God's throne. Right? Because we have God's throne there with the Ark of the Covenant. And as things are going forward, we're going to see how the theme of the garden turns into not just a garden, but a city. Okay, so recap. God will build a garden of people where a seed of David will rise up or grow and establish God's kingdom. So parallel, God's people as trees growing, planting, so will there be one from the line of David who will also be planted and grow alongside them that will usher in this new Eden, this new temple space, this new city, right? But that's not really where we stay, right? We know David is not the one, and how do we know? 2 Samuel 11. In the spring, at the time when the kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the high place. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanliness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, saying, "I am pregnant." So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. Now, we know the story from here. He tries to get Uriah to sleep with Bathsheba, so that way, oh, look, it's actually your kid. I don't have to, right? So there's all this deceit, and when that doesn't work, he sends Uriah to the front line and kills him, sends him to his death, and waits to hear that that is all done. And when Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned him. After that time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. Right? Here's the interesting thing. Bathsheba becomes the fruit of knowing good and bad. Right? The image is David is in Jerusalem. He's on the high place. He's in his palace, surrounded by trees. And he looks, and there he sees, right? It says he saw a woman bathing. There's our key word. And the woman was very beautiful. She was a delight to the eyes, ladies and gentlemen. Ah, much like the fruit was. And so he takes her, and he plants his seed in her soil. And, it, I mean, the, just the imagery alone is just breathtaking. But you see how up there in the high place where we have just been informed that this is like a new Eden, we should be excited, we should be happy, but we can't be because he's now mucked it up. And this begins a pattern, right? Where Israel will be led astray by their kings. Yes, Solomon builds the temple and God's presence rests there. But now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in his statutes and his father's David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on high places. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was a great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. That's 1 Kings 3. Solomon also built a high place for Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Molech, the Ammonites. That's 1 Kings 11. Jerusalem and their king became the new Egypt and Pharaoh, right? If you read 1 Kings 12, boy, we get a very interesting picture there. So 1 Kings 3 through 4 says, after Solomon had died, they went up to Jeroboam, his son, and he and the whole assembly of Israel, Jeroboam was a leader, and they go up to Rehoboam. That is Solomon's son. So it says, so they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." And if you go down, his response is, give me 3 days. And so in verse 13, we pick back up. The king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given to him by elders. He followed the advice of the young man and said, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word of the Lord he had spoken to Jeroboam son of Nebat through Ahijah the Shilonite. Basically, we are now going to read from this point on, because Solomon had turned into a pharaoh. He was enslaving his own people, having them build great structures. He was a giant, creating a giant war machine. And his son, much like the pharaoh we get who did not know Joseph, increases the workload of the people in the same way when Moses goes and asks for him to let the people go, he refuses. And so it actually splits the kingdom. It goes from the unified kingdom of Israel, right, with all 12 tribes, and Israel splits from there, where 10 of the tribes split and go to the north, which will be called now the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, and the southern kingdom will be Judah. And the northerners in the kingdom of Israel make their own temples at Bethel and Dan. So they don't want them going down south now to the temple. So they make their own temple, and they're going to do it better because now there's going to be two. And lo and behold, they're going to put a golden calf in each one. So we're right back to Moses, Sinai, and it's not good. It's not good. Not good at all. And I feel bad because, again, it was not necessarily all the northern kingdom's fault, was it? No. Rehoboam's son of Solomon was king in Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem. The city of the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. Judah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than those who were before them had done. They also set up for themselves high places, sacred stones, and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. There were even male shrine prostitutes in the land. The people engaged in all the detestable practices of the nations of the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. And this begins this long, long diatribe of every king that comes just about out of the line of David and out of the line of Solomon worshiping false idols. Asherah poles. Asherah poles were fake trees, right? There is a goddess that is depicted with the trees named Asherah, and Asherah becomes the signifier of this fake tree, this fake Eden, fake tree of life. And this is what they're doing. They're putting up all the Asherah poles all around. They're worshiping on high places where they're not supposed to be. And this is all kind of gone along like the other nations that have come before them. It's sad. It's heartbreaking. Something else to note, Asherah poles aren't just fake trees, but it's kind of like a backwards version of Eden. You know how like you could say God and dog, it's two different words but jumbled up letters, right? The D and the G are flipped. That's kind of how Eden is with Asherah in that language. And so we just see how just backwards the people have gotten. And yes, there are some good kings and they do try and get rid of the Asherah poles, and that's made known, but judgment is coming. And we know that because of Isaiah. Isaiah gets to the point where we get some interesting details. And this is where we're going to start switching and going, okay, I think we need to go from Jerusalem being the new Eden to pointing originally to something greater. And that it isn't it, and that it needs to be gotten rid of, because it's just as bad as Egypt was. It's just as bad as those who had oppressed God's people to begin with. They have become like the nations themselves. So if you look at Isaiah 1:27, we see Zion will be delivered with justice, her penitent ones with righteousness. But rebels and sinners will both be broken, and those who forsake the Lord will perish. You will be ashamed because of the sacred oaks. Ooh, ashamed. That's the same word, shame, from the garden, right? And we have a mention of trees. In which you have delighted. Oh, another key word from the fall. You will be disgraced because of the gardens that you have chosen. You will be like an oak with fading leaves, like a garden without water. The mighty man will become tinder and his work a spark. Both will burn together with no one to quench the fire. Oh, you can hear the language of Eden just leaking off of the page, and how it's kind of the opposite of what we should find. Psalm 1 paints us a picture of what a person should be. Listen to this. Blessed is the one who does not walk in steps with the wicked, or stands in the way of the sinners, takes or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yield its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. Right? So we hear already this dried up, leaves ready for tinder, that the people are the sparks, and their works are the sparks, and it's just going to cause destruction. We see there the exact opposite of the wisdom of Psalm 1, which begins the wisdom literature. Ugh, heartbreaking. And here in Isaiah 5, we get some more information. I will sing for the ones I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard and on a fertile hillside, a high place. He dug it up and cleared it out of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now, you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, what did it yield? Only bad. Now I will tell you what I am going to do with my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its walls, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delights in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. Oh my gosh. I hope you can begin to see how these patterns are leaping off, not just with trees, but we're hearing the briars and thorns, right, from the very beginning with the curse. There is a new curse happening, that even though the Lord delighted in them, what they offered was bloodshed. There's blood on the ground. And the righteousness, they heard the cry call out. We have a Cain and Abel story being referenced here. So we get all of this saying, exile is coming. He's going to take them away. There's nothing that is going to grow here. This is going to be bad news for Jerusalem and Israel because they are done, right? So that's chapter 5. But in chapter 6, we get a new Moses moment. In the year of King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and exalted, seating on a throne. Well, of course he's high and exalted. He's on the high place. And where is his throne? In the middle of the high place in the temple, right? And the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces. With two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." We should be picturing flying snakes. Why snakes? Seraphim, the root word is snakes, like viper snakes, snakes with venom in them. And it should scare the poop out of us, right? Let's be honest. When we talk about spending time in the Lord's courts in 1,000 years and we sing those songs, Isaiah is getting a vision of this and he is not having a good time. Okay? At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried, says Isaiah. "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." He goes, "I'm a dead man." right? He has the same fear that Moses had. I am somewhere holy and I recognize this. The bush is burning and oh God, I'm going to die. Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from tongs from the altar. The altar, the place of burning, right? You could almost see this as like, if this was the burning bush, he thinks he's going to take it and he's going to die from it. And the altar already has the symbology of taking from the good and bad. And it's almost like a reenactment. So we should all be thinking at this point, not having read anything further, right? That's the mind we're coming with, that this dude is dead. The snake, the flying snake being, spiritual being, is coming at him with fire from the altar, and he's now going to put it on his lips, and he's a wicked person. This is the end for Isaiah, right? That's what we should be saying. And it said, with it, he touched my mouth and said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for. Because remember, in order to get access to the Holy of Holies, you have to pass first by the altar. And it's almost as if he is becoming a self-sacrifice right then and there. Then I heard a voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and whom will go before us? He is now part of the heavenly court. He is now there face to face, if you will, with God. And he says, here I am, send me. And he said, go and tell this people, right? So boom. Isaiah is doing exactly what we hope would happen, that there is mercy and grace towards God, that he recognizes where he is, where he stands, and we're off from there. I mean, just beautiful. Verse 11, then I said, for how long, Lord? And he answered, until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields ruined and ravaged, the gardens are gone, until the Lord has sent everyone far away, and the land is utterly forsaken, exile. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will be again laid waste. But as the tamarind and oak leaf stumps, when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land. So here we're talking about exile. We're talking about the garden being gone. The soil being raised, right? But out of that, we get this idea of the remnant. Because God says, from there, we're actually going to take... we're going to take a little bit. There's going to be something that remains. There's going to be life that forms out of a stump. A holy seed will be in the land. Right? Then the rest of the book of Isaiah develops the image of the new seed that God will sprout into the new Jerusalem post-exile. The tree imagery has connection here with the snake crusher in Christ. If we read Isaiah 10, verses 33 to 11:10. The Lord Almighty will lop off the boughs with great power. The lofty trees will be felled. The tall ones will be brought low. He will cut down the forest thickets with an axe. Lebanon will fall before the mighty one. Lebanon, where the trees of the palace were brought in. He's going to destroy the palace. But a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. The spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will lie down with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put its hand into the viper's nest.
They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. Oh, we have a remnant in the seed coming from Jesse. But notice the reversal of the Eden curse, and the child will play with the snakes with no fear. No destruction or violence on the mountain, and all will know and be in relationship with God. This connection continues in the servant song, specifically the one we link to Jesus. Isaiah 53, right? If we turn to that, Isaiah 53. Sorry, this one's a little bit of a long one, but we're covering a lot of time here. Isaiah 53. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender root, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us, nothing in his appearance that we would desire him. There's fruit, almost like a good or bad fruit, right? There's nothing that is delight to the eyes, good for taking, nothing that we would reach for him. The arm of the Lord is always in reference to Moses, how he lifted up his arms on multiple occasions, and God worked through and in that. And he grew up like a tender root, right? We see this all connecting. It's not just the Messiah, but also the people. The remnant are betrayed as new plants and trees. Again, drawing on Eden language. If we look at Isaiah 27, verse 6, it says, in the days to come, Jacob will take root. Israel will be a bud and blossom and fill the world with its fruit. Isaiah 37, we can continue that theme. 37, verse 30, says, this will be a sign for you, Hezekiah. The year you will eat what grows by itself, and the second year what springs from that. But in the third year, sow and reap, plant vineyards, and eat their fruit. Once more, a remnant of the kingdom of Judah will take root below and bear fruit above. For out of Jerusalem will come a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. Isaiah 41, 17, 20 picks up on this theme, but combines it with the bitter herb story. So if we go to 41, 17 through 20, we hear the bitter water story, right? Then the poor and needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst. But I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will make rivers flow on barren heights, and springs within the valleys. I will turn the desert into pools of water, and the parched ground into springs. I will put in the desert the cedar of the acacia, from myrtle and the olive. I will set junipers in the wasteland, the fir and the cypress together. Right, we can keep going. Isaiah 60, verse 21. Just to continue to drive home this point. Right, 21, 60, 21. Then all your people will be righteous, and they will possess the land forever. They are the branch I have planted, or the shoot I have planted, the work of my hands, for the display of my splendor. 61 continues, the spirit of the sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. For as the soil makes the sprout come up and the garden causes seed to grow, so the sovereign Lord will make righteousness and praise spring up from before all the nations. Even the scriptures here that Jesus is quoting is referencing trees. The Messiah, the branch man, as Tim Mackey, Dr. Tim Mackey calls him, will become an Eden Temple city along with the people. The people, right, as we said, there is one who is coming from Jesse, a branch, a shoot, a seed, and that as he springs up and the kingdom of God comes, so the people are springing up as trees, renewed. And in the wild and waste, in the desert place, Ezekiel sees, and this will be the last spot where we stop, Ezekiel sees a renewed tree of life. And this one's a little harder to see, I think, for some of us, because we don't think, it doesn't explicitly say tree of life. But I think from this pattern on forward, we recognize that there is a healing and a renewing that is coming from the tree of life now for us. Post-garden, we now need healing and renewing. So this is the vision that we get in the tree of life. And it'll be, I believe, it is in Isaiah 47. The man brought me back to the entrance of the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. The water was coming down from under the south side of the temple, south of the altar. He then brought me out through the north gate and led me around the outside to the outer gate facing east, and the water was trickling from the south side. As the man went eastward with the measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits and then led me through the water that was ankle deep. He measured off another 1,000 cubits and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. He measured off another 1,000 and led me through the water up to the waist. He measured off another 1,000, but now it was a river that I could not cross because the water had risen and was deep enough to swim in. A river that no one could cross. He asked me, "Son of man, do you see this?" Then he led me back to the bank of the river. When I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. He said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down to the Arabah, where it enters the Dead Sea." Oh, those bitter waters. "When it empties into the sea, the salty water there becomes fresh. Swarming of life and creatures will live there. Wherever the river flows, there will be a large number of fish because the water flows there and makes the salt water fresh, the undrinkable water drinkable. So where the river flows, everything will live." Oh, so where the trees are that are connected to these waters, there is life. That sounds familiar. "Fishermen will stand along the shore from Ed Gedin and En Glaum. There will be places for the spreading nets. The fish will be of many kinds, like the fish of the Mediterranean Sea. But the swamps and the marshes will not become fresh. They will be left for salt. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they will bear fruit, because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. Their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing." These are presented as trees of life yet again. Trees that never wither. Trees that are eternal, that have a piece of the abundant life and presence of God. And their leaves will be for healing. Oh, so good. So what have we added? I think we have added with David, we see one who is a king priest who will plant a new garden, a new Eden on a high place with God's help. That's important, with God's help. And I think we could add that to the long list of Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham and Moses continuation. Jerusalem is pointing to the reality, but it wasn't it. When David himself pointed it, we realized that we didn't just need someone like David. We needed a new David, right? That's why we get from the stump of Jesse, a new David. And as God is not being worshipped on his mountain correctly, with all these false trees and gods on high places, it leads to Jerusalem also being a corrupted fake Eden that needs to be gotten rid of, and exile happens and death happens. But there is a promise to create a new humanity and plant them in a new garden, temple, city. And so with that, we add something beautiful here. The hope of not just the snake crusher, not just somebody who is by a tree with that will bring salvation and God's life and God's abundance, and there's sacrifice and all those things. We're now showing that the people themselves will be like trees of life, planted in this new garden, this new Eden, this new temple. And it's going to move forward because it's a city. We're going to take that theme forward too. And so we're going to see where this is going. And next, we will talk about Jesus. So, my friends, what are your aha moments? What are some moments where maybe things are starting to click as we're reading these scriptures? Are you jumping ahead? Are you seeing the connections? What's popping out at you and getting you excited? What are some things that are still challenging you? What are you trying to push back against? And most importantly, where do you hear God speaking to you and to us? Well, friends, I am Zach Dierda. This has been our little Faith Connection Bible study on trees, and we hope to see you real soon.